Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. Your readers are Hannah Sullivan and Brian Thornburg. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke, and they can be reached at 800-474-0258. And we thank them for their contribution. We'll begin by reading the USA Today news section, followed by money, then sports, and finally life. At 8:30, our featured program will be Independent Living, which tonight is an episode of History with Ed Tremblay, but now it's time for our TV listings.
Thanks, Brian. On ABC at 8 o'clock, Will Trent. At 9 o'clock, The Rookie. The team investigates a homicide case with a potential tie to the Pentagram killer. At 10 o'clock, the interrogation tapes, a special edition of 2020 about the mystery on the Hudson. On CBS at 8 o'clock, FBI, agents use all of their talents, intellect, and expertise to keep New York and the country safe. At 9 o'clock, FBI International, and at 10 o'clock, FBI Most Wanted. On Fox at 8 o'clock, TMZ presents Arnold and Sly, Rivals, Friends, and Icons. At 9 o'clock, Alert, Missing, the MPU searches for a Benjamin Franklin aficionado who disappeared during one of his city's tours. And at 10 o'clock, WRAL's 10 p.m. news. On NBC at 8 o'clock, Lopez versus Lopez. At 8:30, Lopez versus Lopez. At 9 o'clock, Weakest Link. And at 10 o'clock, Password. On ION at 8 o'clock, Chicago Fire, Herman is tormented by a difficult decision. At 9 o'clock, Chicago Fire, Chili's erratic behavior continues to be an issue for Brett. And at 10 o'clock, Chicago Fire, Severide tries to talk to Chili about her erratic behavior. On PBS at 8 o'clock, Finding Your Roots, featuring actors Valerie Bertinelli and Brendan Fraser. At 9 o'clock, The Expressway with Dule Hill. Artists use their art to reclaim their narratives. And at 10 o'clock, Independent Lens. A teen is targeted by activists after harpooning a whale. On MNT at 8 o'clock, Dateline. At 9 o'clock, Chicago Fire. At 10 o'clock, Chicago Fire. On CW at 8 o'clock, Crime Nation. A father quests for justice for his daughter's murder. At 10 National and at 10:30 National. On A&E from 8 o'clock to 10:30 on the half hour episodes of Neighborhood Wars. On AMC at 8 o'clock, a three-star movie starring Eddie Murphy. This movie is Beverly Hills Cop and it's from 1984. And then at 10 o'clock, it looks like Beverly Hills Cop is repeated. On BET at 8 o'clock and 8:30, episodes of Neighbor. At 9 o'clock, Kingdom Business. At 10 o'clock, Zatima. And at 10:30, Kingdom. On the Disney Channel at 8 o'clock, Haley's on it. At 8:30, Haley's on it. At 9 o'clock, Marvel's Moon Girl. At 9:30, Ladybug. At 10 o'clock, Ladybug. And at 10:30, Ladybug. On the Discovery Channel, Moonshiners. At 9 o'clock, Mud Madness. At 10, Moonshine, Moonshine. On ESPN, starting at 7, NHL Hockey. This is the first round teams to be announced. The latest hockey action from across the NHL. And then at 9:30, NHL Hockey. This is the first round with teams to be announced. On Nickelodeon at 8 o'clock and 8:30, episodes of SpongeBob SquarePants, and at 9 o'clock, 9:30, 10, and 10:30, episodes of Friends. On TNT at 7:30, NBA basketball. This is the Phoenix Suns at Minnesota Timberwolves Western Conference first round, game two. And at 10 o'clock, basketball, Dallas Mavericks at Los Angeles Clippers. And then finally, on USA at 8 o'clock, WWE NXT. And at 10 o'clock, Just Go With It, a two-star movie from 2011 starring Adam Sandler.
All right, we move to the news section and a feature story on that front page, Ivy League crackdown after Gaza war protests. Columbia suspends in-person classes. Yale police make arrests. Columbia University announced Monday that all classes will be held virtually and asked that students who don't live on campus stay home following protests over the Israel-Hamas war that have led to arrests and raised concerns for the safety of the university's Jewish students. The announcement comes after days of protests that have fueled a national debate over student demonstrations as campuses across the country grapple with growing unrest over the war in Gaza. Yale police arrested dozens of students on Monday after they declined to clear an encampment, and Harvard closed its main lawn area to the public in anticipation of protests. Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq said in a statement that while online classes are being held, a working group of deans, university administrators, and faculty members will, quote, try to bring this crisis to a resolution by, among other actions, speaking with student protesters. I'm deeply saddened by what is happening on our campus, she said. Our bonds as a community have been severely tested in ways that will take a great deal of time and effort to reaffirm. New York Governor Kathy Hochul met with Safik on Monday morning to discuss the security situation on the school's Manhattan campus. In a video posted on social media platform X, the governor underscored the need to assure the right to peacefully protest while also upholding human rights laws. The recent harassment and rhetoric is vile and abhorrent, Hochul wrote in a post. Every student deserves to be safe. New York City Mayor Eric Adams, a former police officer, condemned the situation on Sunday and promised that any demonstrators around campus found to be in violation of laws would be arrested. We will not be a city of lawlessness, and those professional agitators seeking to seize the ongoing conflict in the Middle East to sow chaos and division will not succeed, he wrote on X, drawing praise from the Israeli consulate in New York. Alumni, faculty, and parents gathered outside Columbia University on Monday, some concerned about anti-Semitism on campus and others in support of the students protesting the war. Amy Werman, a professor with Columbia's School of Social Work, told USA Today, "We are here to show that we have a place on this campus and we belong here and we're not going to be intimidated." Harriet Jackson, who works at the Columbia Teachers College, says she's worried about Jewish students, faculty, and staff feeling protected, adding that she believes in protesting and would describe herself as pro-Palestinian and against any kind of oppression of any people. Among those trying to get inside of Columbia's gates were alumni supporting the student encampment with supplies. Olivia Baker, who graduated last year from Columbia, was trying to deliver food and electrolyte drinks to protesting students. She was denied entry to campus despite having her ID. Baker, who is Jewish, said she believes her grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, would be out here supporting the encampment. "It's great to feel connected to this community," Baker said, "maybe not to the school and its policies and leadership, but to the alumni community and the kids who are showing out and changing things." At least 47 students have been arrested as of 9:50 a.m. on Monday at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, as police cleared an encampment set up by students last week, where several hundred people were calling on the university to drop investments to military weapons manufacturers. Negotiations between the protesters and university officials ended unsuccessfully late Sunday night, according to a statement from the university. Early Monday, campus police asked the protesters to leave Beinecke Plaza, the university's main lawn, remove their belongings, and show their IDs. When some refused, the arrests began. After the encampment was cleared, hundreds of protesters blocked nearby streets and were heard chanting, "We will free Palestine within our lifetime," according to the student-run Yale Daily News. Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had closed its main lawn to the public Monday morning. A written announcement posted on the entrance gate said disciplinary actions would be taken against Harvard students who bring into the area unauthorized structures such as tents or tables, according to the Harvard Crimson. On Friday, over 200 students and others took to Harvard Yard to demand that the Ivy League school also divest from Israel-related investments, the student newspaper reported. In a written statement on Sunday night, President Joe Biden urged Americans to speak out against an alarming surge of anti-Semitism in the United States. "Silence is complicity," Biden wrote. "This blatant anti-Semitism is reprehensible and dangerous, and it has absolutely no place on college campuses or anywhere in our country. Meanwhile, two conservative New York congresswomen called for Chafik's resignation, even as their colleagues in the House, as well as some local Republicans, stopped short of the same demand. Representative Elise Stefanik said Sunday that, quote, Columbia's leadership has clearly lost control of its campus, putting Jewish students' safety at risk. Representative Nicole Maliotakis, a Republican representing parts of Brooklyn and Staten Island, said Monday that the school's abrupt pivot to virtual learning was proof that Chafik had been, quote, unable to stop the anti-Semitic activity on her campus.
Trump jury hears case from both sides. After 4 days of jury selection, former President Donald Trump's New York hush money trial kicked off for real Monday with opening statements. The case centers on allegations that Trump falsified business records to hide a payment from his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, to porn star Stormy Daniels. Prosecutors say Trump paid to keep Daniels from hurting his 2016 presidential campaign by going public with her story that the two had had sex. Trump denies Daniels' claim and has pleaded not guilty. In an illustration of the international spotlight on the trial, juror number 9 called the court expressing concern about media attention. After speaking with Judge Juan Merchan and lawyers, the juror continued serving. The trial is not being televised, and Merchan has asked the media not to report identifying details of jurors. The jury is not sequestered. Merchan gave jurors extensive instructions, telling them not to be influenced by stereotypes and not to discuss the case with others. And then the statements began. This case is about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up, said prosecutor Matthew Colangelo. Trump orchestrated a criminal scheme to interfere with the 2016 presidential election and covered it up by lying in his New York business records over and over and over again. He described to jurors a meeting among Trump, Cohen, and a tabloid publisher, David Pecker. The men agreed to a three-pronged conspiracy, Colangelo said. First, Pecker would be the campaign's eyes and ears, reporting potentially harmful information to Cohen, who would work to keep it quiet. Colangelo described this as the core of the conspiracy. Second, Pecker would publish flattering stories about Trump. And third, Pecker would use his publications to attack Trump's political opponents. Part of the scheme, a catch-and-kill effort to secure the story of former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who also said she had an affair with Trump, a claim Trump denies. Pecker agreed to have his company pay McDougal $150,000 to keep her quiet by buying exclusive rights to her story but then not publishing it. Jurors will hear Trump in his own voice on tape saying, "So what do we got to pay this $150,000, the prosecutor said. Then came the effort to quiet Daniels, a $130,000 payment to kill the story. Trump's direction and for his benefit, Colangelo said, claiming it was election fraud, pure and simple. Sitting in the courtroom, the former president looked straight ahead, neither at the prosecutor nor the jury, shaking his head at least once. Cohen's testimony, Colangelo said, will be backed up by a paper trail that includes phone logs and business documents and by Donald Trump's own words on tape, in social media posts, in his own books, and in video of his own speeches. Simply put, Colangelo concluded, Trump is guilty. President Trump is innocent, Trump's defense lawyer Todd Blanche began. Blanche said his team will refer to Trump as President Trump throughout the trial out of respect for the office he held. He's also a man. He's a husband. He's a father. He's a person just like you and just like me, Blanche said. Trump turned in his chair to face the jurors and his lawyer. Contradicting prosecutors, Blanche denied that Trump was reimbursing Cohen for the Daniels hush money. Moreover, there's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy, Blanche told the jurors. Blanche added that prosecutors have put a sinister spin on this, as if it's a crime, but jurors will learn it's not. Then Blanche amped up the drama. Daniels' testimony, while salacious, does not matter, he said. Taking his time, he emphasized that Trump denies her claim. paying Daniels for her agreement to not publicly spread false claims about Trump isn't illegal, Blanche told the jurors. As for Cohen, he has a goal, an obsession with getting Trump, and you're going to hear that, the defense attorney said. He has pleaded guilty to lying under oath, and I submit to you that he cannot be trusted, he said. Use your common sense, Blanche said. We're New Yorkers. In conclusion, Blanche reminded jurors they promised to put aside any views they have about Trump and decide based on the evidence presented at trial. If they do that, there will be a very swift verdict of not guilty, he said. After a break, Pecker briefly took the stand for the remainder of the short day. Proceedings ended at 12:30 p.m. because of an alternate juror's emergency dental appointment. Pecker was scheduled to appear again today after Merchan heard his arguments about whether Trump has violated a gag order. Despite the drama, that wasn't Trump's only legal proceeding of the day. New York Judge Arthur Engoron approved a new agreement Monday between Trump's lawyers and State Attorney General Letitia James to reinforce the $175 million bond Trump posted to appeal a $454 million judgment in a civil fraud trial for inflating the value of his real estate empire to lenders. The bond is provided by California-based Knight Specialty Insurance Company, owned by Trump supporter Don Hanke. The collateral for the bond is a cash account with Charles Schwab Financial Services. State lawyers raised concerns that Trump had access to the account, but Trump lawyer Christopher Kyes assured Engoron that Trump couldn't move money out of the account without Knight's approval and that Schwab would not allow it.
Supreme Court declines to hear challenge to vote-by-mail rules. Dateline Washington. The Supreme Court on Monday declined to decide if states that automatically let senior citizens vote by mail must let younger voters do the same, an issue that could affect millions of voters. Mail-in balloting has become a partisan debate as Democrats champion it as a way to increase turnout, and Republicans argue it increases the risk of voter fraud. Documented cases of voter fraud, including those related to voting by mail, are rare. But while uncommon, fraud seems to occur more often with mailed-in votes than with in-person voting, according to the MIT Election Data and Science Lab. Seven states, Texas, Indiana, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee, allow older voters to request an absentee ballot for any reason, but let others do so only under certain circumstances. The court on Monday rejected a challenge to these rules brought by three voters in Texas, just as it rejected a similar challenge in 2021 to Indiana's voting rules. It also twice declined to hear earlier versions of the Texas suit brought by the Texas Democratic Party during the COVID-19 pandemic. The challengers argued that the unequal treatment of voters is age-based discrimination prohibited by the 26th Amendment, which was ratified in 1971 to lower the voting age to 18, and the amendment says the right to vote, quote, shall not be denied or abridged on account of age. Whatever voting rights a state grants to people age 65 and over, it must grant to people under 65, the Texas voters told the Supreme Court in their unsuccessful appeal. They wanted the court to overturn an appeals court ruling that Texas rules are allowed because making it easier for some people to vote doesn't make it harder for others to do so. The New Orleans-based 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals also said that the right to vote when the 26th Amendment was ratified did not include the right to vote by mail. Most states now either mail ballots to all voters or allow all residents to request an absentee ballot for any reason, but Texas said it has taken a different route to protect voting integrity while recognizing that older voters may have limited mobility and other reasons that make it harder for them to vote in person. The state said allowing anyone to request a mail-in ballot would increase the risk of voter fraud. About one-third of voters cast ballots by mail in the 2022 midterm elections, according to the MIT Data Lab. The lab looked at whether expanding mailed voting options increases voter turnout. The research suggested can modestly bump up participation in midterm and presidential elections and could have a greater effect on primary local elections and special elections. The voters who challenged Texas's rules said the barriers younger voters can face to voting in person include lack of transportation, long lines, inability to find or access their voting place, and limited time off from work.
Early forecasts predict sweltering summer. Get those flip-flops ready. All signs point to an unusually hot summer for most of the U.S., weather forecasters say. In a summer forecast map released by NOAA last week, nearly the entire nation is enshrouded in red or orange, meaning warmer than average temperatures are expected for June, July, and August. NOAA said areas where the unusual heat is most likely include the Northeast and a large swath of the West. The weather company, in a forecast released Thursday, also said warmer than average conditions are expected to encompass much of the country this summer. Their forecaster, Todd Crawford, said there are signs in long-range models and climate trends that summer 2024 could end up being one of the hottest summers on record. The two hottest summers in the U.S. were in 2021 and in 1936, according to NOAA. Not all forecasters believe it will be a sweltering summer, though. AccuWeather, which releases its summer forecast on May 1st, told USA Today on Friday that we're looking at a milder than average summer across the U.S., with a couple of hot spots in the Northeast and the Southwest. NOAA meteorologist Anthony Artusa told USA Today the waning El Niño and developing La Niña are factors in the agency's forecast for a warm summer. In addition to those, long-term trends of above-normal temperatures are factored into the forecast. This is especially true in the northeastern U.S., Artusa said. The forecast map released by NOAA shows that only the far northern plains may escape the unusually warm summer. No part of the contiguous U.S. is forecast to have cooler than average temperatures for the summer months. Forecasts show that while a soggy summer could be in store for much of the eastern seaboard, a drier than average summer can be expected across most of the plains and Rockies. Combined with the heat, that could exacerbate drought and wildfires across the West, Artusa said.
Report says no proof that Hamas was involved in UN aid. Review calls for stronger safeguards of neutrality. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday accepted an independent review of the world body's Palestinian aid agency ordered after Israel accused agency employees of helping the attack on Israel that ignited the Hamas-Israeli war. More than a dozen nations, including the United States, halted funding for the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees when the allegations became public. The full review, led by the former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna, was set to be released later Monday. Reuters reported that the review says Israel had yet to provide supporting evidence for its claim that a significant number of UNRWA staff were members of militant organizations. The review calls for stronger safeguards to ensure neutrality, but says the agency already has a significant system to ensure compliance with, quote, humanitarian principles. The review was prompted by Israeli allegations that at least 12 UNRWA employees were directly involved in the Hamas-led attack on October 7th. An additional 30 supported the attack in some way, and as many as 12% of the organization's staff were affiliated with a militant group. UNRWA has more than 13,000 aid workers in Gaza. Moving forward, the Secretary General appeals to all stakeholders to actively support UNRWA as it is a lifeline for Palestine refugees in the region, his office said in a statement. Israeli military intel chief resigns. He cites role in the October 7th attack failure. The head of Israel's military intelligence resigned Monday and said he would retire, citing his own role in contributing to the failure to stop Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7. Major General Aharon Halava appears to be the first senior official from Israel's military or political establishment to resign over Hamas's surprise attack, which killed an estimated 1,200 people. It was the largest loss of life in a single day in Israel's history. Militants also took 253 hostages back to Gaza, where Israel believes more than 130 may remain. Halava, who made the announcement in a letter shared by the Israeli military, was on vacation in the Israeli resort town of Eilat. He was alerted of suspicious militant activity hours before the attack, but was not involved in ensuing deliberations that incorrectly determined the activity was likely a drill. Haliba had accepted responsibility for the intelligence failures that led to the worst security failure in Israel's 76-year history. The military intelligence directorate under my command did not live up to our mission. Haliba wrote in a letter, I have been carrying that black day ever since, day and night, and I will live with the horrible pain every day. Haliba said he would retire once a successor was found. Netanyahu doesn't take blame, pledges gains in wars. Israeli media has been reporting for months that the country's military and intelligence officials completely missed or ignored multiple warnings that Hamas was planning an operation on Israel's border with Gaza. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, however, was not acknowledged or has not acknowledged direct responsibility for October 7th. He has also signaled that he has no intention of resigning, despite growing protests over his handling of the war, particularly over the question of Israeli hostages. Negotiations with Hamas aimed at their return have stalled, and Israel's military campaign in Gaza, now in its seventh month, have not freed them either. In the coming days, we will increase the political and military pressure on Hamas, Netanyahu said Sunday. This is the only way to bring back our hostages and achieve victory. We will land more and painful blows on Hamas soon. In Gaza, more than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed since the war's outbreak. According to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry, the ministry, which does not distinguish combatant fatalities from civilian deaths, says the majority of those killed have been women and children.
Top court to decide fate of Biden's rules on ghost guns. The Supreme Court will decide if the Biden administration can regulate ghost guns by requiring manufacturers of the untraceable weapon kits to conduct background checks on customers and mark their products with serial numbers. The court on Monday agreed to hear the administration's appeal of a lower court's rejection of the regulation. That move follows the High Court's decision last August to allow the rule to remain in effect while it's being challenged. Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh wanted to keep the law on hold. It's the first gun control case added to the Supreme Court's docket for its next term, and it will come after the justices decide, before adjourning for the summer, whether domestic abusers can be banned from owning guns and whether bump stocks are illegal. Ghost gun kits allow people to purchase parts that can be built into a weapon without the usual regulations that come with an assembled gun. President Joe Biden in 2022 required companies selling the do-it-yourself kits to adhere to the same rules as other gun makers, such as keeping records that help police trace the weapons. A panel of three judges appointed by former President Donald Trump to the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in November that the administration was trying to rewrite gun control laws. The Biden administration told the Supreme Court its regulation was consistent with the plain meaning of existing laws. The Fifth Circuit's interpretation, the Justice Department said, would make it trivially easy to circumvent the law. That would lead to a flood of untraceable ghost guns, posing a grave threat to public safety and thwarting law enforcement efforts to solve crimes, according to the department. The law's definition of firearm includes any weapon, including a starter gun, which will or is designed to or may readily be converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive, as well as the frame or receiver of any such weapon. Those suing, gun owners, advocacy groups, and companies that make or distribute the products argued that the definition has long been interpreted to describe actual or finished frames and receivers. Gun control advocates say the kits are a dangerous loophole and point out that police frequently find the weapons at crime scenes. Nearly 14,000 suspected ghost guns were recovered by law enforcement and reported to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives in just 5 months last year, according to the Justice Department. Polymer 80, one of the manufacturers challenging the regulation, is responsible for more than 80% of ghost guns recovered at crime scenes in recent years, the department said. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. in addition to using specially tuned subchannel radio receivers and CRS, streams our programming on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assistive technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say Tune In NC Reading Service to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs during or following the initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on the Listen tab, and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Accessible Pharmacy, a provider of home-delivered prescription medicines with talking bottles, is hosting the first annual Blindness and Mental Health Summit. This virtual and free summit is the largest online gathering of organizations and consumers sharing information, resources, and services focusing on mental health in the blindness, low vision, and disability communities. The Blindness and Mental Health Summit will be held online Friday, June 14th, from noon until 4 o'clock p.m. For more information or to register for this free online event, visit the Accessible Pharmacy website at accessiblepharmacy.com. You will find the Blindness and Mental Health Summit under the Events tab. Get active and get outdoors. The North Carolina Assistive Technology Program has been hosting pop-up fairs at various locations throughout the state. Learn about local resources and get hands-on experience with accessible equipment regardless of your ability at an Adaptive Recreation and Active Living Resource Fair. These fairs are free and open to the public. We encourage everyone interested in staying active, accessible recreation, and leisure activities to attend. A pop-up fair will be held at the following location: Charlotte AT Center in Charlotte on May 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 o'clock p.m. The event is free, but registration is required. To register or to learn more about the NCATP Center nearest you, visit their website at ncdhhs.gov/NCATP. Tactile tours are available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. These tours are designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. They are docent-led and explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engagement of the senses. Tours are by request only and must be scheduled at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please call 919-664-6854 or email accessibility coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncartmuseum.org. Arts Access Gallery is excited to host its second exhibition titled A Celebration of the ADA, featuring works of art created by North Carolina artists with disabilities. As they celebrate their 40th anniversary and the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, commemorates its 34th year, they want to know what you celebrate in life. The exhibition will be on view at Arts Access Gallery in downtown Raleigh, June 7th through July 26th, 2024. The gallery is located at 444 South Blunt Street, Suite 115B in Raleigh. The exhibition is open to North Carolina artists who identify as having a disability and are at least 18 years of age. Works from both established and emerging artists are welcomed. The submission deadline is April 22, 2024. For more information on the exhibition and to apply, please visit the Arts Access website. The full call for art can be found on the Arts Access Gallery page.
I'm going to move to the opinion section of the USA Today. We've got two essays to read for you. This first one is by columnist Rex Hupke. Reminder, he usually writes humorous columns. This is titled, Trump taxing GOP hopefuls is on brand for party takeover. I'd like to congratulate Donald Trump on the speed with which he's turned the Republican Party into something resembling an extortion racket. Aside from sinking his fangs into the Republican National Committee like a hungry bat on a plump Berkshire hog, the man spending his days in a Manhattan courtroom under criminal indictment is now looking to bleed cash out of the down-ballot GOP campaigns. In an April 15th letter, Trump's re-election campaign notified all Republican candidates that if they use the former president's name, image, or likeness on any campaign advertisement, they need to deliver at least 5% of the money they raise back to the aforementioned criminal defendant. You know, a little kickback for the boss man, just enough to get Trump's beak wet. Because, as has been made abundantly clear, the GOP is Trump, and Trump is the GOP. Subheading, the Republican Party is now nothing but a Trump piggy bank. He's got his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, in place at the top of the Republican National Committee's pecking order, and she didn't hold back, detailing the committee's singular focus. Every single penny will go to the number one and only job of the RNC, and that is electing Donald J. Trump as President of the United States and saving this country. Sorry, other Republican candidates. Maybe you can find a different Republican National Committee to help you out. Oh, and in the meantime, if you mention the Republican at the top of the ticket, you need to ship some of the green you raised back upstream to the guy already vacuuming donor money off like a Statue of Liberty-sized dirt devil. If this sounds unbecoming of a presidential candidate who claims to be wildly successful and incredibly wealthy, wait until you see the tacky sneakers and weird Bibles he's selling. Adding to the cash thirst, the former president's campaign is trailing President Joe Biden badly in the fundraising department. A Financial Times analysis released this week found, quote, Donald Trump has raised $75 million less for his presidential bid than Joe Biden and has 270,000 fewer unique donors now than at the same stage of his run for the White House 4 years ago. He'd have to sell a moon-high stack of Bibles to catch up, so the grift must grow. And grow it has with this new pony-up-some-cash push on fellow election candidates. As if actively trying to get Trump's campaign cast in the next Martin Scorsese gangster film, the letter to down-ballot Republicans included this line. Quote, any split that is higher than 5% will be seen favorably by the RNC and President Trump's campaign and is routinely reported to the highest levels of leadership within both organizations. Sure, 5% is nice, that's fine, but you know, maybe do 10% or 15%. That's the kind of thing that gets you noticed, kid. The letter also included this note to any campaigns that use Trump's name, image, or likeness and don't play ball. Any vendor whose clients ignore the guidelines mentioned above will be held responsible for their clients' actions. Repeated violations will result in the suspension of business relationships between the vendor and Trump National Committee, JFC. Yeah, nice little campaign you got there. Shame if anything happened to it, you know. This all sounds dodgy as the day is long, but regardless, here is what all the little Republican candidates not named Donald Trump are going to do. They're going to line up in their fancy Trump sneakers and with their Trump Bibles tucked under their arms and drop an offering in the MAGA hat at the feet of Donald. Frankly, that's what they deserve. They gambled on this guy again, and the House always wins.
And our second opinion, don't dismiss review of gender-affirming care, is by USA columnist Ingrid Jacks. One of the most contentious battles of our time is over what access transgender young people and their families should have to medical intervention. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court jumped into the fray by allowing Idaho to start enforcing its ban on what has become known by LGBTQ+ proponents as gender-affirming care for minors. The country is nearly split between Republican-led states that have acted to restrict puberty-blocking drugs, hormone treatments, and surgeries, and Democratic-led ones that want few, if any, limits. The name-calling on both sides of the issue hasn't helped. Conservatives wary of intrusive treatments are framed as not caring about transgender kids and making them feel unsafe. Liberals are accused of mutilating and indoctrinating children. Maybe the right course of action lies somewhere in between these extremes. With more children experiencing gender dysphoria than ever before, some humility is demanded. There's much that we simply don't know about the long-term implications of giving minors these drugs and surgeries that can permanently change the trajectory of their lives. That's one of the findings of the widely anticipated CAS review released this month. The nearly 400-page report represents a years-long review by Dr. Hilary Cass, a pediatrician, of existing research as well as interviews with young people, families, and clinicians. The review was commissioned by England's National Health Service, which has already acted on some of Cass's interim recommendations. The NHS has said that puberty-blocking drugs will be available only for minors who are in a clinical trial. This follows a trend of other Northern European countries hitting pause on such treatments. Cass's report is written in a clear and compassionate manner, and her findings deserve careful consideration in the United States, too. Cass's conclusions point to a need to slow down on drug treatments, and that the evidence supporting related gender care is remarkably weak. While Cass found that children deserve better, more comprehensive care related to their gender dysphoria, the report cautions strongly against the use of puberty blockers and hormones. Some of the key findings from the pediatrician's report include: there is no simple explanation for the increase in the numbers of predominantly young people and young adults who have a trans or gender diverse identity, but there is broad agreement that it is a result of a complex interplay between biological, psychological, and social factors. The strengths and weaknesses of the evidence based on the care of children and young people are often misrepresented and overstated, both in scientific publications and social debate. The rationale for early puberty suppression remains unclear, with weak evidence regarding the impact on gender dysphoria, mental or psychosocial health. The effect on cognitive and psychosexual development remains unknown. The use of hormones in those under the age of 18 also presents many unknowns, despite their long-standing use in the adult transgender population. Clinicians are unable to determine with any certainty which children and young people will go on to have an enduring trans identity. For most young people, a medical pathway will not be the best way to manage their gender-related distress. These last two findings track with a growing number of young people who are telling their stories of detransitioning and who regret that they weren't offered more comprehensive help before hormones or surgery. Some professionals in the medical field are speaking out, too. Grace Powell, for instance, had believed she was transgender as a teen and had a double mastectomy and took cross-sex hormones before college. Powell, now in her early 20s, has detransitioned. She told New York Times columnist Pamela Paul, "I wish there had been more open conversations, but I was told there is one cure and one thing to do if this is your problem, and this will help you." Others have similar stories. When dealing with children, the traditional medical pledge to do no harm carries extra weight. Young people and their families deserve the best and most reliable information before making any big decisions. Cass's report raises many red flags about how little is known about the long-term consequences of gender-affirming medical treatment in children. She urges extreme caution multiple times throughout her review. Transgender activists act as if the science on this complicated issue is settled. As Cass shows us, that's far from the truth.
I'll move to the money section. In a feature story on that front page, millennials want to retire by 60. Can they afford to? Many may have too little saved to reach that goal. The average millennial is 30-something, an age by which most of us are well-versed in the ups and downs of financial life. It may come as a surprise, then, that the average millennial expects to retire before 60, a goal not many of us can afford to attain. In a poll in February, YouGov asked millennials when they expected to retire. The largest share, 30%, chose the age range of 51 to 60. Another survey by Principal Financial found that the average millennial expects to retire at 59. Other retirement surveys find millennials planning to work well into their 60s, yet Taken together, the report suggests a clear pattern. Millennials expect to retire younger. Older Americans of Generation X and the baby boom expect to retire older. Few workers of any age have the money to retire early. There's a huge difference between wanting to retire at 55 and actually retiring at 55, said Sam Knofzinger, general manager of brokerage at Public, an investment platform based in New York. Retirement surveys reveal a paradox at the center of the millennial Americans' working life. They hope to retire early. They expect retirement to cost $1 million or more, yet they have saved only a small fraction of that sum. One recent report from Northwestern Mutual found that millennials believe they will need $1.65 million to retire comfortably. To date, however, millennials on average have amassed only $62,000 in retirement savings. That leaves a retirement gap of more than $1.5 million. Financing a comfortable retirement in America means using some combination of Social Security, savings, and other sources to replace lost wages in the final years of life. The earlier you retire, the more money you'll need. Social Security doesn't kick in until age 62, and Medicare doesn't generally cover healthcare costs until 65. Most people, the vast majority, would be unprepared to go into retirement before their 60s, said Henry Yoshida, CEO of Rocket Dollar, a retirement platform based in Austin, Texas. Millennials born between 1981 and 1996 are the largest generation in the American labor force, making up nearly two-fifths of the working population in 2020, according to a Johns Hopkins University report. The 2023 Transamerica Retirement Survey of Workers, published by the nonprofit Transamerica Center for Retirement Studies, underscores the generation's dilemma. The largest share of millennials, or 32%, expect to retire before 65, the study found, but only one-third of millennials have written a retirement plan. Most millennials have retirement savings, but the typical millennial has only saved $49,000. One upside is that millennials seem to be planning for retirement earlier than older generations, according to the survey. The median millennial started saving for retirement at 25. The typical Gen Xer, by contrast, waited until 30 to begin saving for retirement. Boomers put it off until 35. For everything I've seen, they've actually had better habits, Yoshida said. They have proven themselves to be far more interested, knowledgeable than Generation X or Boomers in preparing for retirement. I don't think they get enough credit for that. Millennials have endured their share of economic setbacks. Many millennials were in school when the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, entered the workforce during the late 2000s Great Recession, and were entering their peak working years when COVID-19 hit and largely shut down the economy. You just can't catch a break as a millennial, said Knofzinger, who is part of that generation. You had 9/11, then you had the collapse, then you had COVID. Every 10 years, you had a 100-year flood. Those crises shaped the millennials, financial experts say, giving them a stronger sense of living at the moment and a less materialistic outlook than the generations that preceded them. I think the millennial generation in general is more about carpe diem, says Jamie Eccles, a certified financial planner at Plant Moran Financial Advisors in Auburn Hills, Michigan. They don't want to sit at a desk and work until they're 65. They want to travel and have life experience. Michelle Winterfield, a Detroit millennial, is co-founder of Tandem, an app that helps couples manage their money. Winterfield knows millennials struggle to save for retirement, and she doesn't believe it is entirely their fault. I think living expensive has gone crazy, especially for people living in cities, she said. Because home prices and mortgage rates have soared, many millennials lack the funds to purchase a first home, which is a rite of passage for older generations. You're starting much further behind, Winterfield says. A 2022 study by the nonprofit Urban Institute concluded that early millennials born in the 80s are more likely than older Americans to come up short on retirement funds. The study projected that 38% of older millennials will face inadequate income at 70, compared with 35% of early Gen Xers, 30% of late boomers, and 28% of early boomers. The report cited growing wage inequality between rich and poor Americans, among other factors. And what exactly would it take for a millennial to retire comfortably at 55? Everyone's situation is different, but financial planners often say a worker needs to spend at least 25 years building retirement savings, setting aside at least 10% of their earnings. If people have a 12 to 15% of gross income saving rate for a period of 25 years or more, then at the end of that period, they can retire with the caveat that they have low personal expenditures, said Rashida of Rocket Dollar. A millennial born in 1995 could start saving aggressively now and have a good shot at retiring comfortably at 60, said Gene Smart, CEO of Penelope, which is a 401k platform for small business based in New York. But the case might be hopeless for a 40-something millennial who hasn't saved much for retirement, especially someone laden with debt from credit cards and student loans. Even within the generation, Smart said, there's like a tale of two cities.
Savers have options to make cash grow. Interest rate hikes over the past few years have been a saver's delight, but your return can vary based on where you park your savings. Your best bet for snagging the highest rate is an online-only personal savings account, which even beat the average rate on a one-year certificate of deposit, CD, according to the Banking Landscape Report released Thursday by finance site WalletHub. That study analyzed nearly 2,700 deposit accounts. And if you need regular access to your money, rates at credit union checking accounts are 65 times higher than those at regional banks, and they charge lower fees. Credit unions can offer higher rates because of their small, local, and nonprofit nature, which results in lower overhead costs, said Alina Cormorano, Wallet Hub senior researcher. Here are more banking trends and tidbits to help you get the most out of your cash. Where are the highest savings interest rates? Online savings accounts continue to beat their brick-and-mortar counterparts by a wide margin. Their rates are 4.9 times higher than their branch-based counterparts and 3.7 times more than traditional checking accounts, WalletHub said. A few banks recently lowered their online rates. But with the Fed remaining in higher-for-longer mode on interest rates, most online banks should keep their online savings and money market rates steady, said Ken Tooman in his Bank Deals blog earlier this month. After three consecutive months of hotter-than-expected inflation, economists lowered their forecast for rate cuts this year to between 0 and 3 from as many as 7 at the start of the year. A run-of-the-mill online savings account yielding 3.84% annually is roughly 24% more than the average one-year CD of 3.09% annual percentage yield, WalletHub said. So where are the best checking accounts? Credit unions have the lowest fees, highest rates, and most features, WalletHub said. On average, they're 47% cheaper than checking accounts from small banks and 75% less expensive than those from national banks, it said. They also have roughly 1.6 times more features, and their rates are 8.1 times higher on average. Credit union members are also shareholders, which means that profits are returned to members in the form of better rates and lower fees, Camarano said. This is in contrast to banks, which aim to prevent profits for their stockholders, he said. To save money, consider electronic statements wherever you bank. The cost of receiving a paper statement grew by 8.95% over the past year, WalletHub said. Where are the highest CD rates? Again, credit unions win across all maturities from 3 months to 5 years, WalletHub said. National institutions were the lowest across the spectrum. Regional banks were second with the best rates in shorter maturities, 3 months to 1 year, but community banks ranked second for 2-, 3-, and 5-year CDs. Specialty checking accounts. Business accounts are the most expensive and offer the lowest rates, WalletHub said. They're 87% more expensive than branch-based personal checking accounts and 5.6 times more expensive than online-only personal checking accounts, the report said. Their interest rates are generally 66% lower than personal accounts and have 68% fewer features than online-based personal accounts. Small business owners who aren't looking for business-specific features should gravitate to personal banking options whenever possible, much like with credit cards, WalletHub said. Student checking accounts have the lowest fees, making them 73% less expensive than their general consumer counterparts. But lower fees come at a cost, WalletHub said. interest rates offered to students are 84% lower than those for the general population.
House boosts uncertainty over TikTok. Passage of bill would be a big blow to the popular app. Time might be running out for TikTok. In March, the House voted overwhelmingly to approve a bill that would force Chinese parent company ByteDance to sell TikTok's U.S. operations. The bill then moved to the Senate, where its future was uncertain. Last week, House Speaker Mike Johnson tied the measure to a foreign aid package for Ukraine and Israel, putting it on the fast track to becoming law and increasing the possibility of a ban in the United States. The House approved the emergency spending package Saturday. The measure passed on a bipartisan 360-58 vote. The Senate was expected to take up the measure this week, and President Biden has promised to sign it. One possible hitch? Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, who opposes the TikTok bill on First Amendment grounds and the foreign aid package it's attached to, says he wants to drag out the vote. But he conceded in an essay published Friday, "The censors who abounded Friday on Congress will likely vote to ban TikTok or force a change in ownership. It will likely soon be law." The bill would be a major blow to the popular app that is used by as many as 170 million Americans. It would force ByteDance to sell TikTok's U.S. operations within months of the legislation becoming law or face a nationwide ban. It is unfortunate that the House of Representatives is using the cover of important foreign foreign and humanitarian assistance to once again jam through a ban bill that would trample the free speech rights of 170 million Americans, devastate 7 million businesses, and shutter the platform that contributes $24 billion to the United States economy annually, TikTok said on Saturday in an emailed statement. Even if Biden signs the bill into law, it will face a slew of legal challenges from TikTok and its supporters. TikTok said it will exhaust all legal avenues before it considers divestiture. From ByteDance, the popular app has successfully fought back similar measures in the courts. The bill itself gives ByteDance nearly a year to divest TikTok, 9 months with a possible 3-month extension, far longer than the 6-month deadline the original House measure proposed. Senate Commerce Committee Chair Maria Cantwell of Washington State said the extended deadline could help the bill survive legal challenges. The Chinese embassy is meeting with congressional staffers to lobby against the legislation, two Capitol Hill staffers told Politico. Apple removed several apps, including Meta's WhatsApp and Threads, from its app store in China at Beijing's request in apparent retaliation for the legislation. The popular app has faced scrutiny over its Chinese control that lawmakers say poses a national security threat. TikTok says it has never been asked to provide U.S. user data to the Chinese government and wouldn't anyway. TikTok has also come under fire for the way its algorithm recommends videos to users, including videos on sensitive subjects and videos about the Israeli-Hamas war. President Biden supports the forced sale of TikTok, but so, quote, has not called for a ban on the app, his top science advisor said at Semafor's World Economic Summit. The big issue for TikTok, from a national security perspective, is about the vast amount of information that the platform is able to collect about people, and specifically, the fact that because of its ownership, that there's a direct line to the People's Republic of China, which is in the geopolitics of today, and it's a deeply concerning issue. Arati Prabhakar, the White House Director of Science and Technology Policy, said free speech advocates have spoken out against the possibility of TikTok ban. They say banning TikTok is the wrong way to address concerns about the practices of social media companies. China and other foreign adversaries could still purchase American sensitive data from data brokers on the open market. They could still engage in disinformation campaign using American-owned platforms, says Nadine Farad Johnson, who's the policy director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. The Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, a science and technology policy think tank, also opposes the TikTok bill. TikTok says it considers any law that would force a sale as the equivalent of a ban because of the hurdles facing any deal. Divestiture would also require Beijing's approval, and last year the Chinese government said it opposed a forced sale. While the price tag will be eye-popping, TikTok's strategic value and consumer platform will have a number of financial and tech strategy players interested, said Wedbush Securities analyst Dave Ives. Investor groups and major tech giants, including Microsoft, Apple, and Oracle, will consider bids, according to Ives. He also expects joint bids from a handful of big tech companies. Another key challenge is TikTok's algorithm, which recommends videos to users. The bill prohibits ByteDance from controlling the algorithm. China has cracked down on Chinese tech companies exporting these technologies. Ives said China and ByteDance, quote, will never allow the source code to be sold to a U.S. tech company in our view. In addition, detaching the algorithm from ByteDance would be a very complex process, which with much scrutiny from U.S. regulators, he said.
And now we'll turn to the sports section with an article by Jarrett Bell, a USA Today columnist. In post-Bill Belichick draft, Patriots look to fix roster. One thing to know about Elliott Wolf is he assumes the role as final decision maker during the NFL draft for the New England Patriots. He's nobody's dictator. Yes, it's a different day in Foxborough, Massachusetts. If I'm the only person that wants a player and everybody else in the building doesn't want that player, then I'm not crazy, Wolf said during a pre-draft news conference on Thursday. We're going to try to do what's right. Consensus. That's a fundamental desire for Wolf 42 as he prepares to run the first Patriots draft since 1999 without Bill Belichick in charge. Obviously, at the end of the day, somebody has to make the decision, said Wolf, the team's scouting director. But there's a group of people that we are relying on to help make those decisions. That's the spirit. Of course, rookie head coach Jared Mayo has a significant voice, and the inner circle includes personnel executives plus coordinators. Then again, as good as it looks on paper, striking consensus in an NFL war room is not always automatic. Depending on how the board shakes out, Wolf might find getting full agreement as one of the stickiest challenges in his new role. The biggest issue you have as a first-year general manager is you are really looking to please everyone, said Mark Dominic, the former Tampa Bay Buccaneers GM and current NFL analyst for SiriusXM NFL Radio. You want everybody to be on the same page, and that can be a mistake, and you can really mess it up because you got the job because you're an evaluator, he said. So what happens if an area scout pushes one prospect while the coaches prefer another? Said Dominic, you want Elliott Wolf to trust his scouting instincts and the years he put in to just go with what he thinks is best instead of trying to have community happiness. Wolf knows the buck must stop somewhere. And given how critical this draft is for a franchise seeking new life after Belichick and holding the third pick overall after a 4-13 finish in 2023, Wolf needs to win at this ASAP. Of course, that means they can't miss on picking the franchise quarterback from a top-heavy crop of passers. Barring something major, Caleb Williams won't be an option with the Chicago Bears locked in to select the Southern Cal star with a top pick overall. And the reigning Heisman Trophy winner, LSU's Jaden Daniels, might be gone, too, to the Washington Commanders. That could leave the Patriots picking between North Carolina's Drake May and Michigan's J.J. McCarthy. Wolf played it coy as he met with the media on Thursday, demonstrating that he has the pre-draft smokescreen messaging down pat. Asked if he could envision Daniels, May, or McCarthy running the Patriots' offense, he agreed and added, I think you could open it up to some other names as well. Is he thinking Washington's Michael Penix Jr. or Oregon's Bo Nix? You could at least suspect that, as he suggested, he'd be willing to trade down from the third slot. We're open to anything, he said. Moving up, moving down, or open for business in the first round and in every round. We have some holes we feel like we need to fill in the draft. We're drafting to develop the team. The more picks we have, the better, he said. Until further notice, Wolf is the de facto GM. Patriots owner Robert Kraft has indicated that he will formalize the role later, which could involve an expansive search. Yet Wolf, entrusted to fill out Mayo's first roster with the draft and free agency, can undoubtedly secure himself as the front runner for the permanent GM post by acing the big test that looms. It's fair to wonder whether Belichick, just 15 victories from surpassing Don Shula as the NFL's all-time winningest coach, would still be coaching the Patriots had he relinquished control over personnel decisions. Sure, that seems unfathomable when considering the power Belichick wielded and the 6 Super Bowl trophies he won. Yet the mediocre draft record in Belichick's final years says otherwise. Over the past 10 drafts, the Patriots selected just one position player, since traded quarterback Mac Jones, who earned a Pro Bowl appearance with the team, fewest by any NFL team during that span. According to Pro Football Reference, 2 players drafted by the Patriots during that span won first-team All-Pro and or Pro Bowl honors with the team as special teamers, punt returner Marcus Jones and punter Jake Bailey. And 2 other Patriots draftees since 2014, guard Joe Thuney and receiver kick returner Braxton Berrios, won such honors while playing for other teams. But that's it. As much as New England's fortunes soured after Tom Brady's departure, the collective draft performance was also a key ingredient to the decline, a striking contrast to the type of impact generated during the first half of Belichick's reign. Now Wolf, who joined the Patriots as a consultant in 2020, is pegged to spearhead a fresh approach. His pedigree doesn't hurt. His father, Ron, is the Hall of Fame GM who built a Super Bowl winner with the Green Bay Packers during the 1990s. Elliott was 10 years old when he attended his first scouting combine with his father. Through high school and college, he learned the ropes in the Packers scouting department. Hired by his father's successor, Ted Thompson, he climbed the ladder during 14 years with the Packers. It's no wonder that Wolf talks about the Packer way as a model. This includes the grading system that Wolf and Highsmith have installed, scrapping the Patriots' previous role-based measures to a value-based system. It's a little bit more similar to what we did in Green Bay, Wolf said during the combine. I think it makes it a lot easier for scouts to rate guys and put them in a stack of like, this guy's the best, this guy's the worst, and everything in between falls into place, rather than sort of more nuanced approaches. I just think it makes it accounts value better, and it also makes it easier for the scouts in the fall, as well as in the spring, to determine where guys would get drafted, he said. Then there's the old school advice from his father that could impact Wolf's current mission. I think in terms of scouting itself, it's just kind of trust, what you see and believe in it, Wolf said, but also lessons about people. I still believe, and this is great to be able to work with Jared, who also believes that this is a people business, and it's about developing people, and the culture is created from the people in the building. He could get a consensus, too, if the culture is built with winning.
Over to baseball. Dynastic Astros not about to panic, Dateline Washington. Their track record is unassailable, the byproduct of 7 consecutive trips to the American League Championship Series, yet this April has proved so grim for the Houston Astros that it's fair to wonder if their sheen of invincibility may finally vanish once the warm weather turns warm. Oh, it's early. Early enough that Alex Bregman has yet to hit a home run, something he'll likely do 2 to 3 dozen more times this year. Early enough that future Hall of Famer Justin Verlander has pitched just 6 innings. With that, the loss of 6 starting pitchers on the injured list has made an outsized impact on the season. There's no sugarcoating losing 16 of your first 23 games, though, particularly in an AL West that looks more unforgiving this season. At the moment, the Astros are an amalgam of misfiring parts, with the calendar sure to determine if those components are ill-fitting. For now, the Astros' best asset remains what they've done and not what they are. Having that experience creates that no-panic zone for your club, says first-year manager Joe Espada, the bench coach from 2018 to 2023. We've been in this position before, with our backs against the corner before, and we know how to fight back. I expect the guys to continue to fight back. The question is how much a gradual attrition from the glory years and a pair of odd expenditures hinder their ability to do so. With each passing year, the Astros look less and less like their 2017 and even 2022 World Series champions, and that's typically okay. The free agent bleed that saw George Springer and Carlos Correa leave for nine-figure contracts was somewhat inevitable. Bregman, the two-time All-Star third baseman, could join that parade after this season. The unscripted part of it was the sign-stealing scandal that forced out general manager Jeff Luhnow and manager A.J. Hinch after the 2019 season. Former scouting director Mike Elias had already departed to construct what appears to be another monstrous potential dynasty in Baltimore. Hastily hired GM James Click and future Hall of Fame manager Dusty Baker held things down fine, winning the 2022 title with a blend of old and new guard. Yet Click was essentially shown the door by Crane after that season. And before new GM Dana Brown could be hired, Crane bestowed a three-year, $58.5 million contract on aging slugger Jose Abreu in November of 2022. Abreu was a below-average producer last year, though he did perk up to slug four homers and produce a .945 OPS in 11 playoff games. This year, however, the bill for Crane's somewhat impetuous transaction might be coming due. Abreu, who's 37, has started in a 4-for-59 sinkhole with one extra base and 17 strikeouts to three walks. He can't fall much deeper than the eighth spot he typically occupies. Perhaps more alarmingly, his defense at first base has been abysmal, no small factor in his startling minus 1.4 WAR already accumulated. He bungled an easy foul pop Saturday, his third error of the season. The extra life granted Washington Nationals catcher Riley Adams resulted in a go-ahead fourth-inning sack fly, and the Nationals scored two ninth-inning runs and one in 10 innings. Abreu was out of the lineup on Sunday, and GM Brown told the Astros radio broadcast that Abreu is, quote, going to have to climb out of it, or else we're going to have to mix and match because it's tough to keep going in that direction. Abreu's struggles might have been expected, the bullpen's not so much, always the most volatile unit of any club. It, for now, represents another potentially flawed expenditure. Crane is loath to give out large guarantees to free agents or even his own players beyond Jose Altuve, which made the $95 million contract given to closer Josh Hader a bit surprising. Reeling in an elite free agent closer rather than a starter was certainly a choice, particularly when Houston's rotation faced significant injury and performance questions entering this season. The theory was that Brian Abreu, erstwhile closer Ryan Pressly, and Hader would form an impenetrable wall in the 7th, 8th, and 9th innings, but the formula has blown up. It hasn't helped that six starting pitchers either started the year on the injured list or landed there, resulting in two unheralded prospects, Blair Henley and Spencer Arrighetti, making their major league debuts in a three-day span. The results were predictably brief and grim, throwing a struggling staff into further flux. Houston has already used 22 pitchers, matching its total for the entire 2023 season. But Brian Abreu, Pressly, and Hader have simply been bad. Pressly, 8.31 ERA, and Hader, 8.38 ERA, have given up runs in five of their first 10 and 11 outings, respectively. Hader on Friday had the sort of night that leads to bullpen arrhythmia. He recorded his second save but allowed three base runners and required 30 pitchers to do so. That rendered him unavailable for Saturday, and the formula collapsed. We're going to continue giving them an opportunity, Espada told reporters after Saturday's loss, because we need those guys to win. Relief, in the form of a more viable starting pitching, may be on the way.
Broncos land Jets quarterback Wilson in pick swap. The systemic failure of the 2021 NFL Draft's quarterback class continues to crystallize. On Monday, the New York Jets agreed to trade Zach Wilson, the second overall pick of that year's draft, to the Denver Broncos. According to a person familiar with the situation, the Jets pick up a sixth-round draft pick in the deal while also sending a round seven selection to Denver. The person spoke on the condition of anonymity because the deal was not yet official. Wilson becomes the fourth passer selected in round one of the 2021 draft to wash out with the team that drafted him. He joins Trey Lance, Justin Fields, and Mac Jones, who have all switched addresses within the last year. However, Williams' failures are among the most glaring. Selected to replace Sam Darnold and reset the contractual clock at the position and after a spectacular pro day at BYU, Wilson ultimately proved a regression from Darnold, who had almost no help around him during his three seasons with the team. The Jets effectively threw in the towel on Wilson in 2023 after trading for four-time league MVP Aaron Rodgers. Then were quickly forced to turn back to the BYU product, who again miserably failed in his third attempt to produce at a level commensurate with his draft billing. Wilson's completion rate, 57%, and passer rating, 73.2, rank among the league's worst over the past three seasons. That futility married to 23 touchdown passes and 34 turnovers. Wilson was on the losing end of 21 of his 33 NFL starts. Wilson joins a Denver quarterback depth chart that currently includes veteran journeyman Jarrett Stidham and Ben DiNucci, though the Broncos are also expected to draft another passer this week. And while Wilson should push for a job on the roster, his lack of accuracy and poor decision-making to this point in his career don't portend a fruitful marriage with Coach Sean Payton.
Let me move to the life section, and a future story on that front page is a viewing guide. April's streams are overflowing. They say April showers bring May flowers. This month also unloads a deluge of movies to watch at home. Netflix, Amazon's Prime Video, Peacock, Max, Apple TV+, Paramount+, and others have a spring fiesta of streaming options for film lovers of all tastes, from breezy romantic comedies to bone-chilling horror. There are recent theatrical releases, such as an acclaimed Oscar-nominated Holocaust drama and one of the most Disney-fied Disney movies ever, but also original flicks such as Zack Snyder's latest sci-fi epic and a Sundance Film Festival documentary about politically savvy teen girls. So here are some notable new movies that you can stream right now. First one, Argyle. In director Matthew Vaughn's madcap adventure, Bryce Dallas Howard plays a best-selling novelist who discovers that the fictional exploits of her secret agent character, played by Henry Cavill, are coming uncannily close to things happening in real life, leading her to partner with a shaggy actual spy, played by Sam Rockwell. You can see that one on Apple TV+. Next, Bob Marley, One Love. So good as Malcolm X in One Night in Miami, Kingsley Ben-Adir notches another biopic highlight as reggae superstar Bob Marley. He's effective at capturing the musician even if the movie meanders with a narrative set during the 70s as Marley tries to use songs to bring together a politically divided Jamaica. You can see this one on Paramount+. Drive Away Dolls, Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan co-star in director Ethan Coen's gonzo crime comedy as lesbian pals needing to change of pace who wind up behind the wheel of a rental car with a mysterious briefcase in the trunk. What unfurls is a noir-soaked road trips full of sex toys, decapitated heads, and dim-witted goons. You can see that one on Peacock. Girls' State, Amanda McBlain and Jesse Moss's compelling follow-up to 2020's Boys' State, centers on teenage Missouri girls placed in competing political parties to create a mock state government. Abortion is a hot-button issue in the proceedings, which include a competitive gubernatorial race and an investigation into girls' state itself. That can be seen on Apple TV+. The Greatest Hits, the car accident that killed her boyfriend left Harriet with head trauma and the ability to time travel to a past moment with him when she hears certain songs. But obsessively searching for the right tune to save him in the past might cost her a new chance at romance in the present of this intriguing but overly earnest drama. That one can be seen on Hulu. Late Night with the Devil. David Dasmalchian has a hell of a role in his retro horror flick, starring as a 70s late-night TV host in desperate need of ratings. For a Halloween special, he brings on a girl supposedly possessed by a demon in a gambit that brings in eyeballs but spirals supernaturally out of control for everyone involved. You can see that one on AMC+. Lisa Frankenstein, a horror rom-com about reanimated undead love and body-robbing shenanigans. Lisa is a playful and bloody teen movie reimagining of the Frankenstein mythos. Catherine Newton plays an 80s goth girl, and Cole Sprouse is a Victorian corpse resurrected amid lively characters and clever, sardonic dialogue. You can see that one on Peacock. Migration. In the animated comedy Mag, voiced by Kumail Nanjiani, and is the overprotective dad of a duck family who reluctantly agrees to a Jamaican getaway with his wife and kids. However, they get sidetracked and wind up in New York City, where they meet a streetwise pigeon and a vicious chef. You can see that one on Peacock. Musica. Randy Mancuso writes, directs, and stars in this delightfully clever romantic comedy as a creative New Jersey man with synesthesia, experiencing melodies and rhythms around him in extraordinary fashion. It exacerbates problems with an ex, yet fascinates a new love interest. See Musica on Prime Video. And Night Swim. Thinking about putting in a pool in the backyard? Well, think again. Wyatt Russell plays an ex-baseball star who moves into a new house with his wife and kids and feels swimming could be good for their souls, but the outdoor pool contains a dark force that doesn't have fun in its plans, and that one you can see on Peacock.
Meet the newest class of inductees to the Rock Hall. A mix of first-timers and longtime hopefuls made the cut as 2024 inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The eight entrants in the performer category span rock, pop, and hip-hop and were announced during the live broadcast of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Night episode of American Idol on April 21st. The newest Rock Hall inductees are Mary J. Blige, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Kool & the Gang, Ozzy Osbourne, and A Tribe Called Quest. In addition, the Musical Influence Award will go to a trio of blues heroes, Alexis Corner, John Mayall, and Big Mama Thornton. Jimmy Buffett will be honored posthumously with the Musical Excellence Award, along with MC5, Dionne Warwick, and Norman Whitfield. The annual Amit Edigun Award will go to screenwriter, TV producer Suzanne DuPasse, who served as executive producer of Showtime at the Apollo from 2002 to 2008. The ceremony to honor the new class will take place October 19th at the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse in Cleveland and stream live on Disney Plus and on Hulu the next day, with an airing on ABC at a later date. Ticket information for the show is forthcoming. Five of the inductees landed on the ballot for the first time this year: Cher, Foreigner, Frampton, Kool & the Gang, and Osbourne, who already is inducted as a member of Black Sabbath, which received its coronation in 2006. Blige also was nominated in 2021. A Tribe Called Quest learned that the third time is the charm, following nods in 2022 and 2023. And Dave Matthews Band, previously the only fan vote winners in 2020 to not land on the final list, won this year's fan vote again, and this time was chosen for entry. The fan vote counts as one vote with the general voting body. In December, Cher told Kelly Clarkson on her talk show that she feels the Rock Hall snubbed her for years. "You know what? I wouldn't be in it now if they gave me $1 million," she told Clarkson. "I'm never going to change my mind." Other 2024 nominees who weren't chosen for this year's induction include Lenny Kravitz, Mariah Carey, Sade, and Oasis. To be eligible, an individual artist or band must have released its first commercial recording at least 25 years before the year of nomination.
Yeah, the books, article about books, funny story goes deeper than just laughs. The weather's getting warmer, so obviously it's time for another banger read from Emily Henry. For a subset of millennial women, the author has become a summer staple, freewheeling romances that defy the stereotypes of beach reads, starting with her 2020 debut cheekily titled Beach Read. Henry has become a reliable source of yearly can't-put-them-down stories about love, friendships, and getting older. Her latest, Funny Story, takes the traditional opposites attract narrative and gives a realistic, if somewhat tragic, twist. Children's librarian Daphne Vincent, Henry's characters always love to read, has moved to an idyllic Lake Michigan beach town with her fiancé Peter, slotting herself into his preferred life and the house he bought. But when Peter leaves her for his childhood best friend just weeks before their wedding, Daphne doesn't have a place to live. She winds up bunking with Miles, the ex-boyfriend of Peter's new love. He's a punky, fun-loving charmer who everybody loves, and she's bookish and reserved. They don't have anything in common except their shared heartbreak. But isn't that just the perfect setting for a new romance? It certainly checks a lot of rom-com setup boxes, but Henry wisely keeps Daphne's journey far from perfect. There is real grief and trauma here, plus a loss of self and identity. Before Daphne can even think about falling in love with Miles, she has to start loving and knowing herself again. Maybe that's not the stuff of traditional beach fluff, but for so many women who have been lost in romance in an unhealthy way, it's deeply cathartic. And once the time for romance is right, Henry doesn't disappoint. It's sweet, passionate, and just hot enough to steam up the book, if not set it on fire. Just as in her other novels, the author's characters are deep, realistic, and relatable, Daphne is quiet and guarded, and having grown up with an absentee father, she has no faith in anyone to live up to her expectations. Gregarious Miles has more issues than meet the eye, and unfolding his inner life takes the reader on an unexpected journey as he and Daphne become friends and something more. Henry is so particularly talented at creating romance that eschews tropes and cliches, but still satisfies our innate desire for predictability and happy endings in this genre. It's certainly not easy to balance the comforting formulaic with the tantalizingly unique story. Might hit the mark best of all of Henry's books so far. It's a funny story. How she does it, actually, you should take a read. It's time for a couple of short items as we wrap up a shift. Two New Jersey friends win the Powerball jackpot. A New Jersey friend duo is $1 million wealthier after hitting a jackpot by winning the Powerball this month. According to a social media post from the New Jersey Lottery, the men who have not been identified are best friends. The lottery draw date took place on April 3rd, and the lucky pair bought the ticket at a deli in the unincorporated community of Atco, which is part of the Philadelphia Camden metro area. Lottery officials publicly announced the men won on X over the weekend. One friend told lottery officials he plans to buy a beach house. His best friend reported he will save his winnings for retirement. Trader Joe's basil is making people across the country sick, with the grocery chain store confirming Wednesday that the product was connected with a multi-state salmonella outbreak. The outbreak is linked to Infinite Herbs brand organic basil, packed in 2.5-ounce clamshell packaging, sold between February 1st and April 6th. A dozen people from 7 states were infected, with 7 of 8 cases reporting that they became ill after purchasing the Trader Joe's basil, according to the FDA. At least one person has been hospitalized, and the 7 states are Florida, Georgia, Minnesota, Missouri, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Hannah Sullivan and Ryan Thornburg have been reading from the USA Today. The broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke, and they can be reached at 800-474-0258, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program, and at 9:30 for readings from the News and Observer. Up next, our featured program, Independent Living.